Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation, that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. It is May 7th, 2025, and I have with me today Albert Norton, a practicing attorney and author of several books on the tension between religion and postmodernism. His most recent book is The Discovered Self, just released, concerning what he regards as a dangerous inward turn to the therapeutic worldview. Those of you who are familiar with the work of Philip Reif will recognize that language, and we can probably get into that later. We'll be sure to get to that as we go on, but our main subject today is his 2023 book, The Mountain and the River, which is subtitled Genesis, Postmodernism, and the Machine. In it, he finds a through line to postmodern philosophy, namely, that it amounts to a search for meaning upon rejecting God as its source. Welcome to the show, Bert.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Now, before we get to the books, I want to start by asking you about the conference. This was your first one, as I understand it. We met back in Harrisonburg, Virginia for the first time here in March 2025. What did you think?
Oh, it was great. It was not only my first time at a Ciceronian conference, it was my first time at any sort of academic conference, because that's just not real. I'm not an academic myself. So this was new to me. I am eager to try new things. So I did. And it was fantastic. It was 3 days of talking with people about big picture, you know, big meaningful ideas, just one after the other. And the presentations were, I mean, they weren't all great, but most of them that, and of course you choose what you want to go to. And most of the ones I heard were just right up my alley. I really enjoyed them.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. In many instances, it is the first conference for many people. So as far as you know, it's the greatest academic conference out there.
That's not the just key. On my own authority. I actually talked with others who I said, look, this is, you know, I haven't been to one of these. Do you go to academic? Of course, they all have gone to lots of academic conferences. And I heard more than once that, yeah, well, this one's a little bit different because everybody likes each other. there's no backbiting, no academic, you know, internecine warfare, no jockeying for position. People come back to this because they genuinely like each other and they want to. So, yeah, that was great.
That is the secret sauce, if you will. I think there's it's one I cannot take credit for it. It's one of those things where a bunch of people who liked each other found each other and just kept going to this conference. And that continues to be the case now. Correct me if I'm wrong about this next question, but I don't know many practicing attorneys who are writing short stories and philosophical monographs like this. And so in addition to coming to, you know, I mean, I know you have your Substack. I know you've written these books, you came to this conference, but what led you to take up, to do this at all with this writing and to specifically take up these topics?
Well, first of all, to the general idea, you know, how am I able to do something like this? I'm not trying to maintain a professorship or anything like that. I'm blessed at my stage of life to be able to practice law a little less and pursue other things that I'm interested in more. And that's what I'm doing. So I have been for many years, more than 20 years, reading philosophy of, you know, general interest type philosophy, introductory type works, just trying to get past some of the difficult lingo and so on, because I'm interested in the big ideas, the things that move society and move that have to do with our relationship to other people, political, but more significantly cultural, large movements over time. And so I was engaged in that back in the I guess, the mid-aughts when the new atheism was the big thing, and read them all. Read them all. Never made any sense out of any of them. The first nonfiction book that I published was trying to turn the tables and say, look, you're telling me what you don't believe. I mean, that's what atheism means.
Right.
But you're not telling me what you do believe about these metaphysical subjects. So I was trying to turn the tables and say, instead of attacking Christianity or theism generally, why not defend materialism, which is basically where the new atheists went to? There wasn't really hardly any explanation of why this must be true, just that whatever you Christians believe, it's not true. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I did a good job on that, but that was the intent with that book. I'll say from there, I kept reading because, I wasn't trying to turn into a Christian apologist necessarily. I was just appalled at some of the new atheist stuff I read. But I had this nagging curiosity about postmodernism, because what is it? I mean, aside from something that comes after modernism, what is it? Mm-hmm. I had a sort of vague idea about it with respect to art, but as I say, quite vague. And so I did what anybody of my disposition would do, is I went out and read books about postmodernism. And I did, I must have read a half a dozen of them, and I did not learn anything because I figured out that if I want to understand what postmodernism is, I'm going to have to read the people that are identified as postmodernists. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I launched into Derrida and Foucault, and quickly realized that just the thinkers post World War II were not going to do it for me. I understand about the deconstruction and Frankfurt School and so on, but there's more to it.
Yep.
And so I reached back and through a lot of reading. I won't go through what was most particular in that reading, but I figured out to my satisfaction that we've made a shift from a theistic worldview, whether you actually believe in God or not, but a generally theistic worldview to a, you can call it secularist or whatever, materialist, I suppose. But there was a tipping point in society when that happened, and it's had huge ramifications. So when was that, and what caused it, and where are we now? That's the answer that I tried to get to in reading, not just the people who are called postmodernists, but thinkers before them, going back, well, a long time, to see where we are today.
It's really interesting, and it makes sense to, having read the book now. I mean, the only book of yours I've read so far now is The Mountain and the River, and the way you just described that was how I essentially interpreted what you were doing, where this is someone who says, I'm looking at the world as it is, especially in the world of law, and you're seeing how the practice of law, the way people are acting with each other, the way politics is happening, the way culture is happening. You can see it in the education of our children and just what popular culture looks like. You can see all this stuff, and it's clearly not okay. Right? It is a mess. And so you're saying. And that's what I really appreciated about this book, was that it was an attempt to say, what the heck is going on? Because
it was, because it's not enough to say the whole world's going crazy, so I'll try to have as little to do with it as possible. That's
right.
That's not the answer.
Well, I found the book to be very insightful. It was the ground you covered was very familiar to me, but I think that's just because of my position. But I don't know how much you've read of folks like Eric Voglin, Russell Kirk, Martin Buber. Well, I caught a little glimpse of that in there. Alistair McIntyre. But their spirit seems to inhabit a lot of this, just trying to make sense of this modern, postmodern turn, however you want to describe. I mean, one of the ways we can bring this up later, but is it postmodern or is it just hypermodernity, right? But and at the conference, you actually also presented on Philip Reeve. I'm curious to know, because he doesn't come up in this book that I remember, in The Mountain and the River. Had you encountered his work before you wrote this?
Yes. I had not all of it. I'd read the Triumph of the Therapeutic, mm-hmm. And I think I'd also read The Mind of the Moralist, Freud, The Mind of the Moralist.
Right.
but I hadn't gotten into as much later works at that point. And so the distinction I think I would make is that when I was writing The Mountain and the River, the whole world of psychology and the unconscious and all that kind of stuff, it was still a little bit intimidating to me, even though I'd read Reef and some other things. And I was talking about proposition. So I was in The Mountain and the River, I'm presupposing that you're a logical, intelligent person. If you don't have a philosophical background, I'll try to define all the words and terms that I use as I go along, and in hopes that you'll persevere. But it was all kind of propositional, I would say. In other words, I'm dealing with the flow of ideas over time. I'm not really trying to get into the subconscious. And didn't really feel like I had all the tools to do so at that point. But as I was writing that book, and as you point out, it was in 2023, right at 2 years ago it came out. I had been reading for, along with the other stuff I was reading for The Mountain and the River, I was reading Philip Reeve and other things, and was already developing an inclination to go there, so to speak, to see if I can have something valuable to, well, first of all, figure it out and see if I have something valuable to say about the subconscious and the way we think about the subconscious and what it has to do with the weird sort of feelings oriented inward turn that people seem to have that puts them in a position of sort of vulnerability and kind of a timorous state of inability to deal with the world, because that's what I see all around me. It's worrisome.
It's this, and it comes back to the whole the how we think about God, how we think about the religious or irreligious or anti-religious turn that we've seen as well. Because there, I don't think you used the word moralistic therapeutic deism, the idea from Christian Smith and others who have brought this up. But was that kind of in the background here? Because I could see you. It's kind of funny to say this now, but like I could see you in the book moving toward Reef. And in some ways also, again, I don't know how familiar you are with Eric Voegelin, but I thought I could sense his influence here. But that you're moving in that direction. But is that moralistic therapeutic deism? Is that also kind of what you're seeing as well? Not just the new atheists, but this also kind of watered down theism, right? Where we still believe in God, but he's just a genie or a
Yes.
guru or a yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I think I mentioned moral therapeutic deism, but in a very conclusory way,
Yeah.
because I'm talking about the church. And I say, too much of the church is given over to moral therapeutic deism without really even understanding it.
Yep.
And then I kind of left it alone because I wanted to stay with big picture philosophical ideas. I didn't want to be too down on the church, and I didn't want to exceed what I know, because there are lots of commentators out there who are talking from an explicitly Christian point of view or a theological point of view about what's going on. And I was trying not to do that because, for one thing, I'm not a theologian, but for another thing, I see that there's been this unfortunate divide between theology and philosophy going really way back. And that's part of the problem. So I was trying to stay on the philosophy side, and not get into too much of the woo of religion.
Well, I think your humility comes through in this book. But at the same time, I will say that having read plenty of peer-reviewed oriented articles by philosophers, theologians, and others, you're in good company. You have reasons to be happy with yourself at this point. I think there's lots of things that you've read that many who should have read them have not read them, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
And I'm grateful for that. But I want to go back some of the details of The Mountain and the River specifically. And I'd like to say, for you to expound first on your key metaphors, that is the mountain and the river, and why
Sure.
you chose to frame your argument in that way.
Yeah. Okay, great. I'm so glad you asked that question because that's so central. So if you look at the subtitle of the book, it's Genesis, Postmodernism, and the Machine. And I could talk about the machine. That's where I think we're headed. This it puts us in sort of a dangerous place politically as a society. And but that's a relatively lesser part of it. The main thing is Genesis and then postmodernism, because I'm contrasting those two in particular. What I'm saying is Genesis is reality. And then I'm saying that postmodernism is a departure from it. So let's start with that. And so the reason I start writing about Genesis is definitely not to exegete it. I'm not qualified for that, but to say that, look, anybody can read and read what it says, especially the first two or three chapters, about it, what it's telling us, metaphorically, analogically, but also literally what it's telling us about what human beings are and what our relationship to God is. And the reason I went with the mountain and the river is because I'm sort of using that as a heuristic for the for that whole analysis. Because in the reading, I'm of course I'm trying to find a big through line through all of these philosophers, and what I'm seeing, it's expressed in a lot of different ways by a lot of different people, but they're describing a dichotomy, a differentiation, an ontological dualism, I would say, between certain ways of thinking that are psychological to the individual and are cultural to the society. And the ways of thinking are contrasted in a lot of different ways. But if you think of the mountain as standing for eternal truth, it rises from one level to another. It's a hierarchy of values. It is moral realism. It is unchanging. It is a it can be perceived as stern and mastering God, maybe a God who is mad at me, you know, that kind of thing. You can think of it as being oppressive. You can think of the mountain as. At the other extreme is the river. So this it's flowing, it's changing. It would represent moral relativism, but there's something that's quite valid about it, and that is that that this flow, this potentiality, this creativity is absolutely necessary to the way individuals think and to the way society moves, and how we can understand how ideas change over time. So if you go to the second verse of Genesis, and this is why I'm saying this is right there in Genesis, it's telling us what's true, what's real. So the second verse is that the earth was formless and void, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Well, I wish I knew how many times I read that. At first, I'm thinking, wait a minute. How are there waters that are uncontained? How is there the earth and yet it's void? I mean, what's going on here? And what I think it is metaphorical language to understand this first major division. That God, I mean, the first verse of Genesis is in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And from there, all kinds of differentiations and divisions cascade from there in reality, conceptually, ideally, spiritually. And that goes back to the ontological dualism I mentioned. Then you get to the second verse, and it's doing the same thing. It's another great major division, a fundamental division, let's say. In concepts that are well above our quotidian concerns, but are telling us about reality. And so what you the Spirit of God, you could think of as the mountain that's drawing up the reality we know from the chaos of these waters. Now, this is the symbolism that's, you know, it's not new, I'm sure, to you, but the waters that represent potentiality, creativity, and a human disposition against oppression and against and against liberation, against being told what to do, all of which is legit. And so I'm trying to set up the mountain and the river, and in fact I wrote this thing and I thought, oh no, what if my publisher doesn't like the title? Because I've used it in every chapter. But that all worked out. So that's the main heuristic I'd say from the mountain and the river.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but this sounds very much like the old debate between universal and particulars, right?
It
Is
is.
it, yeah, that kind of thing between Plato and
Well,
Aristotle to a point.
it overlaps. So,
Right.
in thinking about how to put this together from a sky-high perspective, I'm saying the mountain and the river is a sort of heuristic that I use all the way through the book, but also I start out with this idea of differentiation and unity and multiplicity. Because if you recall, since you read it recently, I started out talking about trees, for goodness sake. You're walking along, there's oak trees and hickory trees. Well, why? Why can we notice that the difference between the two, and why do we notice the commonality within one type of tree and within another type of tree? And come to that, what is it about my conscious mind that enables me to decode it that way? This is hugely significant, and so it's the logos, and it's the mountain, you might say. So I try to stick with that all the way through, because I'm making a lot of commentary about what's rational thought, and what opposes rational thought that we have to contend with in our makeup.
Well, to me, this is classic. You know, what you're doing here is classic philosophy. It's you're taking the elements of experience and knowledge and what you encounter, what you feel and see, it not just in an empirical sense, but that you're taking this life that you're living, the things you're seeing, that what you're encountering, you're saying, you know, we're taking for granted this reality. We haven't subjected it to some kind of inquiry and questioning. And for you, it's this desire. You start from the premise that there is a reality, that there is truth that can be known, and that
Yes.
it's not that we as human beings are not indifferent to it. It is not indifferent to us. And so let's figure out what all this, you know, in the broadest sense possible, what all this is and what it means for us. And to me, I think it's also refreshing that you there's a piece here. I don't think you mentioned the ideas of personalism or the notion of a person in the kind of this transcendent philosophical sense. But I think that's behind here too, because you're saying, and this goes back to kind of why you wrote these things at all. It's like we seem to be losing touch not only with reality in general, but specifically also what it means to be a human person.
Yes.
And you know, and that's why, I mean, there's a lot of we don't have to get into it as much here, but you know, in the middle of the book, you talk a lot about sex and sexuality and gender, and that's just one piece of this confused anthropology, if you will. And so I think that's a really, really key point here.
I mean, I think it's really central. Obviously, sex and sex differentiation is central to what we are as human beings, but it does connect to a much bigger idea. We're not animals, and we either have there either is a God, and that has breathed some God stuff into us, inspired literally, or there's not. We're either and that's kind of the big jump between from the theism that was prevalent, or at least the ideas behind theism that were prevalent before, and postmodernism now. So this is the through line, and all that stuff in the middle that you mentioned about sexuality and so on is me continuing to talk about what is reality before I switch over at some point to talking more specifically about what postmodernism is, so that hopefully a reader will get the contrast.
Well, let's actually look at your definition of postmodernism. So this is on page 116 of the book, and it says, you write that postmodern philosophy is a collection of theories which hold in common a rejection of objective truth and morality. Postmodernism, more generally, is not just the theory, but the praxis by which theory is deployed into the culture. And you give seven elements of this: atheism, or resolute atheism, blurring of boundaries, you know, resolute leftism, neo-Marxism, socialism, anti-fascism, but with the important qualifier that fascism just means antipathy to capitalism as bourgeois culture. I want to come back to your discussion of fascism later. Opposition to meta-narratives. Let's actually camp out there for a minute, because one of the things I wanted I'm not sure I can't tell if you're going to agree with what I'm about to say or not. So it'd be interesting to see how you respond to this. To me, there's two dangers here where we could totalize, if we want to stick with your metaphors, the mountain or the river, in a way that might obscure our understanding of reality. So one of the ways that a professor of mine, Klaus Wren, he used to discuss was he would talk about he would draw on Irving Babbitt, who mentioned a oneness that is always changing, in a kind of Aristotelian sense that the universals are only known through the particulars. We only know these, as you're saying, objective moral truths, objective truth and objective morality through changing examples, if you will, there are universals, but we can't access them except through the particulars. We can't access, you know, this is kind of, it's a kind of incarnational way of thinking as well. We can't access the God without the incarnation in Christ. And so I'm wondering here, to what extent, because on the one hand, I'm sympathetic, right? We don't like this postmodern movement away from boundaries, away from hierarchy, away from any authority whatsoever, away from tradition. Basically, and this is what so much of the of postmodernism and critical theory, et cetera, they don't give you anything. They just tear down and replace it with nothing. Because if they replace it with anything, it might violate your moral autonomy, and moral autonomy is the god of postmodernism in many ways. And so what I'm saying is that is there another danger here? Where if we get so strict on, and this, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, we get so strict on this objective truth and objective morality that we fail to see some level or some opportunity for difference and diversity and that's a loaded term, but different expressions of the same truth. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. As I understand it, I would say that I completely agree with that. As a matter of fact, that's why I choose the metaphor I did, and that's why I've gone through. I'm not just saying, hey, get out of that river, mm-hmm. you kids, and climb up this mountain. You know, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Right, right, right.
In fact, what I'm trying to say is, look, both of these impulses lie within us, and both of them are manifested in the world around us. And we need to get this right. In fact, in order to understand that even Genesis is telling us that, I wrote a chapter called Mythos and Logos, just to try, you know, not trying to get into a debate about how to interpret Genesis, but rather to say, look, both of these are legitimate ways of seeing the world.
Right.
And Philip Reeve did this, by the way. I had not read Charisma, I don't think, at the time that I don't remember when I read it exactly, but his book Charisma, I think this is how he's defining charisma. It's the combination of these things.
Okay.
Because there's absolutely mystery involved in religion. We have to be comfortable with that, because it involves things that are so much beyond us. I mean, that's the point of it. That's the point of understanding transcendence, is that it is beyond us, and we are trying to understand it as best we can in our limited way. So I completely agree that you don't want a totalizing one way or the other. As a matter of fact, if you can follow what I'm saying about the analogy here, I'm not trying to say the mountain is God. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to say that the interdicts, to use Philip Reeve's terms, some of them are based on eternal, unchanging moral truths. That's certainly true. And that's a mountain feature, you might say.
Yeah.
But the potentiality of human beings, the spirit moving with us, the immanence of the spirit, all of these are river kinds of ideas. Maybe I can illustrate this way. So this is not in the book at all, but recently I saw a 4-hour documentary on YouTube, and it was called the Century of the Self. Maybe you've heard
okay.
of that.
No, I've not heard of it. That's interesting.
Okay. I had not. But it's apparently been out there for a long, long time. In fact, it kind of goes through the 20th century, but it more or less stops during the Reagan era. So mm-hmm. I infer that it's been out there a while. But It talks about Freud. They talk about Freud and his legacy. And consistent with what Reif wrote in his book, Freud, The Mind of the Moralist, they're saying that there was kind of a repressive mode in the first half of the 20th century because the Freud family and the people who strictly followed Freud were afraid of this dangerous inner id. And were in favor of kind of conformity, and they wouldn't say repressive, but, you know, certainly boundaries, social boundaries that we erect. And, you know, so we're going to all be bourgeois and consumerists and that kind of thing. And then so that is that, let's call that a repressive mode. So then, according to this documentary, there's a shift, and the shift is away from the repressive mode into a liberationist mode. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to put liberationist in quote marks because I think it ensnares us now. I think it is a move from the mountain to the river, except that it's excessively river. Okay. Yeah. So who doesn't want liberation? But this is following on with Marcuse and it's the whole 60s hippie era and so on. And it's continuing to this day. It is out of balance. We're missing the charisma that Philip Reif talked about, because if you abandon the mountain altogether, you abandon even the notion of sacred order. We can't live without some sort of interdicts. Where do they come from? And they're all going to come from the social norms, positive law. We're all expected to be positivists now. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger of getting out of whack between the mountain and the river.
Yeah. One of the Irving Babbitt, going back to the positivist thing, Irving Babbitt famously said, it's a terrible way to say this, but he said he wants to be a more complete positivist, as he said. It's a stupid way to say what he's trying to say, but I think what he's trying to get at is, and I think what you're trying to get at is that you're trying to see reality in every sense of that word more clearly, more accurately, and live into it, not against it, because it's a reality made by a loving creator God that we don't have to run from. And so much of postmodernism is running from that reality, or actually more accurately, especially today, is trying to create that reality for yourself, right? Going back to the Planned Parenthood v. Casey, famous statement, freedom is to, I'm not going to get this right, but to create your own reality, essentially. That's what liberation is. But just like you say, and you show that throughout the book, is that it leads to the exact opposite. It leads to pain, to suffering, to nihilism, to meaninglessness, to an emptiness that just is not, because so much of it is just not in line with what it means to even be a human person. Let me ask you about this other metaphor, though, the metaphor of the machine toward the end. That's another piece of your subtitle here. What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, let me say it probably not as good a way as I did when I was thinking it through writing
it's
the
all
book.
Right.
But so if what I'm saying is that by virtue of leaving behind any sense of the transcendent, we throw mountain and river dispositions out of balance, if that's true, which obviously I'm saying it is. Mm-hmm. Where does that leave us as a society? And where, and by extension, what's it going to do to us individually? Although that's maybe more the subject of my later book. But what does it do to us as a society? Because I've long had, parallel to these other interests, concerns that I've been expressing, I've long had this concern about the consolidation of power, the managerial elitism, the betrayal, frankly, of democracy, that we see these tendencies towards what I can only see as a looming totalitarianism.
Right.
And I keep seeing it. I kept feeling it. So how can I explain it? And I'm trying to do that in this book because I think it's a consequence of getting away from this idea of correctly balancing mountain and river. And of course, I say that's only doable by recognizing the transcendent. So the machine, I look at, there's lots of references to this in some philosophical thinking going back, way back, One instance of it is Max Weber's or Weber. I need to sound like a real philosopher. Max Weber's his famous book.
Protestant,
Think
oh
of it a
gosh,
minute. Turn.
the Protestant theory of capitalism, or the oh gosh, what's his other?
So
Yeah, that one.
he talks about the iron cage,
Yeah,
and it's
okay,
kind of
yeah.
a, and this is way back. I mean, this is 120 years ago, but he's that's sort of a precursor to what lots of other writers are going to talk about as being a an increasing sense of being captured in the works of a machine. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I get on my computer and I'm trying to do something and it tells me we need to update, and I say I don't want to update, and then I realize I'm talking to an inanimate object, and I don't like working for my computer. It's supposed to work for me.
Right.
That's a dumb little example, but you take that in writ large across society, where you go to pay for your groceries with cash and they look at you like you have two heads. What we don't realize with all of these technological advancements is that we are slow to being captured by the machine in a sense, because you can't just do things in a simple way. Sometimes you can't do them at all, just because of the technological interdicts, to use a Reifian word, that have arisen up all around us. All right, so that's sort of a very kind of visceral reaction to machine-like circumstances. But it goes back to Weber's iron cage. It's expressed in a lot of different ways. Paul Kingsnorth has written about this, and I'm eager to get his recent book on the subject. And on Substack, I see lots of discussions about it. My favorite reference point for this concept of automatism was reading Ernst Jünger's The Glass Bees. It's fiction, but if you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it. I think he wrote it in 49 or something like that. I wrote a review of it because I thought it was so powerful. He writes in a sort of Reifian way, incidentally. So he's talking about the machine in an appropriately abstract way. So it definitely applies today. In fact, it's so prescient, I can't believe it. So that's what I'm getting at with the machine. What I'm concerned about is that this continued movement away from the mountain towards the desire for liberation does not liberate at all. In fact, it's going to be replaced by something quite repressive. And what we're really doing is, in the interest of enhancing the aesthetic, liberated, creative potentiality that we all have, we're missing any kinds of boundaries and structure to our life at all. So, you've got the breakdown of the family, which is a structure, the breakdown of marriage, the sexual revolution, and all of the diminution of important interdicts on what it takes to be a human being. All of these things are rapidly dissipating, and it's gone so far in a liberationist direction that it's going to end up unliberating us, so to speak. And when you combine that with power structures, so I talk a lot about Marxism in this book, because it's a replacement of a love paradigm with a power paradigm. And so all of these are moving us towards power structures that will necessarily enslave us. There will be interdicts. We just won't like them, and it won't have anything to do with what we are as human beings.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it makes me a lot of thinkers come to mind here as you're describing that. Heidegger's question concerning technology, but as well as people like Neil Postman, Marshall McLuhan, Christopher Lash, others who have, well, actually, a great example would be C.S. Lewis and That Hideous Strength, which increasingly is very prescient. I mean, and this is why, I wonder how much postmodernism, if that label makes sense. To me, this is just modernity on steroids or cocaine or something. I don't know. It is just so into itself and its ability to try and perfect freedom, if you will, or perfect liberation, and to perfect humanity, that it will go to any extent, including the abolition of man itself, to do this. And yeah, well, again, but it's still driven by that power over reality, power over the self's power over everything and everyone. And that any threat to that power is oppressive, is somehow against us. Now, I want to turn before, because I want to make sure we get to your new book. But before we leave the mountain and the river, I want to get to your definition of fascism. So you talk about it in a lot of different ways, but I'm looking on page 269 here in particular, because this is where I think your book is insightful all the way through, but this is particularly insightful, I think, because talking about fascism is so, I think, very challenging, because it seems to come, you know, it's often associated with the right. Which, you know, you're rejecting that here. But it's also very, very poorly defined, right? I mean, the way we use it in common parlance is just, it's just like liberalism, right? What, it's meaningless at this point. A fascist is someone who doesn't, give me what I want. Like, is that all it is? Right. I mean, that's that, mundane, if you will. And you're right. You say that the new fascism is just like the old, except more pernicious and more tenacious. The old involved subsumption of the self into a totalitarian state embodied in a dictator. So we're thinking about Mussolini, you think about Hitler. The new involves subsumption of the self into a totalitarian machine disembodied from individuals and formed and sustained in the coercive collective. The machine of the new fascism is not limited to a government. It includes collective reinforcing big business and especially big tech, with accomplices in legacy media, education, other social media. I agree with you here, and it's very much like Alexis de Tocqueville's soft despotism, right? I mean, is that kind of what you're getting at?
Absolutely. Because there's no, you know, there's no dictator with a funny mustache standing over us, making us do things. Instead, it's sort of a coercive collective. So you get rid of God, you get rid of the mountain, you get rid of eternal ideals, and whatever the interdicts are. I keep coming back to that word because it's a great word. Mm-hmm. That was the mountain was the source of the interdicts. The river is not devoid of interdicts. It's not all liberation all the time. It's not do your own thing, man.
Yeah.
Instead, we get our interdicts out of the flow, so to speak. And I need to maybe leave the analogy at this point, but basically society comes up with its norms. It's all positivistic, to go back to that word. Society comes up with its norms, and that replaces the values of the mountain. And the society's norms, this is relativism, society's norms move and change because that's what happens in a river. Well, not because of that, but that's why the river analogy applies.
Right.
So those norms are moving and changing. And that's where the meta narrative, well, the narrative, I should say, is so important, because you got to really keep up, you know, if you want to know what's okay today and what's not okay tomorrow. And so you gotta have one ear to the ground all the time to figure out what's okay today and what's not okay today. And that's the nature of what we go to. We don't give up. We don't really get full liberation. We just get repression from a different angle. This time it comes from the God of society, not from the God who is God.
Right. And that's the God of society is very unloving and fickle, right? I mean, the God of the Bible, for us, is a God who loves you no matter what, right? I mean, and the God of society will throw you away as very quickly. Actually, you know, the way you're describing this now, I didn't think about this when I was reading the book, but it gets to a problem that I see in churches all the time, especially in Protestantism has really fallen for this in many ways, although I'll get to the Catholic example here in a minute. But there's so much of this emphasis that, well, if we don't change as a church, if we don't accommodate the zeitgeist of society, then, you know, we as a church are going to die. We're, you know, people are going to leave us. We're going to be in trouble. No one's going to like us anymore. You actually see it, and that's kind of that river-ish mentality, right? It's very relativistic. Society is becomes the god of unfortunately, of the church. And actually, you see it being imposed in the coverage written. So today is May 7th. It is the first day that the conclave is meeting to elect a new pope. I'm not Catholic. I'm Anglican, but I find the coverage of this particular event. And by the time this is published, we'll have a new pope. But you know, there's the coverage of this conclave has been so disturbing to me because there's this emphasis on will they get a pope who everyone likes now, right? Or who you know, grows the church because it kind of gets with the times, right? Or will they get someone who's backward and conservative and you know, I don't know, Catholic?
Yeah, like we're electing president of the Catholics,
right? Exactly. Yeah, we need the Pope to be representative of everyone. Really? Is that? I'm no Catholic, but I'm pretty sure that's not what the original design was. You know, so I think there's. It's striking how much this has not only infected society at large, secular society, but also kind of started to infect the church, and not even just started. It's been there for a while, but has certainly impacted the church's understanding of itself. It's like we want to. I made this image in a different in something I wrote. I don't know when I did this, but the image I had was of the church holding the Bible up to society and saying, "You tell me what it says." Because I just want you to like me, right? That's basically what's going on.
Yeah, I'm not Catholic either, and I probably have not followed those developments as closely as you have. But I do when I do hear about it, it's exactly the way you describe, and I'm thinking, well, gee, I thought the purpose of the conclave was to discern the will of God here,
right?
Not to figure out how to balance different political interests, and I think they may be rightly motivated by doing it. Well, not entirely, obviously, but they may have a positive motivation, which is you know, we need to keep people focused on the truth, religious truth, mm-hmm. and we don't want to get pulled off in various directions with crazy new theories. We you got to get people in church before they'll listen to you.
I think that's
probably some of what's going on. But the danger with that is that you lose the ultimate truth that the church is trying to reach people with to begin with.
Right. And I think that there's a huge tension there. I currently work for a church, and there's always this tension of saying, this evangelistic heart that comes from a very good place. We want you to come to this church. Come be part of this family. We want to spend eternity with you, right? I mean, that is the Christian heart. At the same time, we don't want to compromise what we believe to do that, right? It's not here. It's come as you are, but. It's not stay as you are, right? There is a truth. There's formation. There's development. I mean, kind of you don't lead with this, but so much of the Christian life is this call to come and die to self, right? And that's I think you can lead with that in the right context, but that's the last thing that contemporary society wants to hear. Come and die? No, that's not what I want to do. But that is what we are called to do.
There's a real tension there, and I'm sympathetic towards church leaders who are trying to navigate that. But I think they've gone too far in the direction of softening the message, and thereby not delivering the real message behind it. And the churches are just full of people who are there because that's what good people do.
Right.
That's the extent of it. They're not Christians.
Yeah. No, I agree with you entirely there. It's kind of this residual, you know, barely residual Christianity. And that's true. Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox. It's there through all of them. Now, I want to, you know, we're really good at critiquing things. We can say everything that's wrong. And hey, you know, we can look at ourselves and say, look, I'll just freely admit I'm part of this problem, too, in many instances. But where is the, and you start to get to this at the very end of this book, you know, where is the hope in all this? And what do we as Christians do in response? Because I think there is cause for hope. What is it, and where do we find it?
I think it starts with understanding. And I don't mean another really smooth sermon from the pulpit necessarily, but there's something that people used to understand that has somehow gone by the boards, and that is what I describe. I think I used this phrase in my last book, not the one we're talking about, but the tragic sense. There's this tragic sense. Let's really, really, really start with the basics. I mean, you're a human being. What do you know about yourself? Well, for one thing, you know you're going to die. For another thing, you know that you are not perfect. So
Speak for
what do you
yourself.
do
Just
with
kidding.
this?
Yeah.
If you're not perfect, and you know there's justice, and you know it's real. So what does that mean for you when you're as out of line as you know you sometimes are? Or maybe a lot, maybe a little, but you know you're not you're not the first non-sinner among humankind. Okay, so what does that mean? I mean, you're going to die. What happens next? I mean, people sort of, again, it's back to the what I'm not instead of what I am. Well, what are you? What is going to happen? Do you just sort of disappear and now you're a nothing for all of eternity? Because so you are nothing. There was nothing there for an eternity up until you were born. Then you're here for a blip, and then you die, and then there's nothing. Is that real? And what about justice? Because justice is a real thing. We all know this. So why do you think that does not indict you? This is a tragic sense that we all live with, or you could call it a sense of alienation, or there's other words for it by various philosophers over time, but this is something we have to reckon with. And the postmodern ideology that we absorb unthinkingly, if we're not careful, it tells us the opposite. It what it does, it doesn't tell us the opposite. What it does is it steers us away from thinking about any of this stuff. Right and wrong comes from what society says. And so your job is to figure out which way the wind is blowing and go in that direction. And that's the only way to live in any kind of way that helps you deal with this. You ignore the tragic sense. You don't figure out how to reconcile it. And all of Christianity is telling you how to reconcile
I think it's also interesting, you just go with whatever society said. That's one way to look at it, right? Where your decision is, I'm just going to go with whichever way the wind is blowing with society. I'm not going to deal with this tragic sense. I think there's another
it.
side to this, which is, in some ways, is the same thing, but a different version, right? Is whatever society's doing, I'm not going to do it, right? It's you're still not going to God. You're still not going to the Bible or to any kind of sense, any kind of objective truth. It's just that you're saying it's a different version of postmodernism, where you're saying, all right, I'm either going to go with society and just go with the flow and do whatever they say, or I'm going to always define myself against society, right? It's this other, it doesn't necessarily lead you to more hope. It may give you some, a way to kind of navigate reality, but it doesn't necessarily give you a greater hold on it. I did my dissertation on Henry David Thoreau, and I have a lot of mixed feelings about him. But he at times he was like that, where I thought to myself, you're just so reactive against everything society is saying that you're doing the same thing that that the conformists are doing. You're just you're conforming to anti-conformity. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's society's controlling you either way.
Right.
I mean, I think I even put a little picture in this book somewhere where I'd say there's two triangles. So in one triangle, there's me at the bottom left corner and you at the bottom right corner. How do we discuss anything? Well, at the peak, at the top of this triangle is God. And what I mean by you could, if you want to go there, you could say, well, okay, let's talk about the mount. Let's talk about eternality of values. Let's talk about a hierarchy of values that is real, embedded in the cosmos. And then there's another triangle, same thing, me at the bottom left, you at the bottom right, and the peak this time is society. And that shift from the first to the second represents the shift to postmodernism to me.
Let's I don't, you know, we I'm sure with the, your new book, we could do an entire another an entirely new podcast, and maybe we will down the road. But let's just give us a preview of your newest book based on what we've talked about so far. And you've already kind of given us a little, you know, hints here and there. But this newest book, it's called The Discovered Self, correct?
Yes.
Excellent. So what,
Well,
where are you going with that?
if you're not looking, well, say up, but at least outside of yourself for truth, where are you finding it to play off of what we just talked about? You're not consciously looking at what the new idea of the day is so that you can immediately fall in line with it, or so that you can immediately oppose it. What you're doing is it's a little more involved than that. I think what you're doing is you're looking inside yourself. Instead of looking out and up, you're looking down and in. And the idea, because I was trying to understand for the longest time, and this is not, this book is not by any stretch a polemic about transgender or anything like that. But it is a good illustration because I, for the longest time, I had this, how do you, how does one, I mean, you don't think you turn it, if you're a boy, you don't think you turn into a girl. I mean, that's not what's going on. Instead, what's going on is that there's this emerging sense of self that's within you somehow. And it's kind of like the creation of the world out of the chaos of the waters. It just emerges. It's there and you discover it. And so when you decide, if you're a boy and you decide that you're going to be a girl, you don't really decide that. You don't think, huh, what do I want? Do I want to be a boy or a girl? You don't do that. What you do is you consult the true you, the authentic you that emerges. I think that's what's going on psychologically. And so when I talk about the discovered self, and that's just one example, as I say, I don't even talk about transgender ideology much in the book. But what I am talking about is the more the more the broader way in which that phenomenon occurs, that we consult the emerging inner being in everything. And there's a and that's and that is the emotivist stance. I don't evaluate what you tell me on the basis of its truth or falsity according to some external standard. I evaluate it based on how it makes me feel. I mean, that's the essence of emotivism, which I talk about a lot near the beginning. And so that's why it's the discovered self. I explain the divided self. I look at some writers who've talked about how the self can be, in a sense, divided. But that's why I'm calling it the discovered self. I literally mean you look within and discover yourself there. That's what is being sold. In that whole therapeutic worldview.
That sounds a lot like Carl Truman's book, right? The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, kind of that same idea in a way.
I talk about him a lot.
Yeah.
I think I've read all of his stuff that's on this subject.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, the discovered self. I was thinking, you know, instead of the common trope that we might use and say all truth is God's truth, kind of the more the postmodern paradigm, as you're calling it, is that my truth is all the truth, right? Essentially,
Yeah.
or the only truth that
Oh,
matters,
absolutely.
right? And
Yeah.
that's a striking way to live. But I wonder though, and this maybe you get to this in the book, because one of the ways that we could hear this critique of the discovered self, one of the ways that we could hear this frustration with this inward turn, where it's like it's kind of this toward moral autonomy and toward, you know, everything inside, you know, only looking into myself for what is, you know, good, true, and beautiful. Does that mean we should just distrust our emotions or distrust the sense in which we are individuals made in a very, very specific way by God? So I wonder if, you know, where is the line between where I examine my emotions as being, you know, possibly ways that God is speaking to me. And that is revealing who's part of who I am as an individual in a very distinctive way. And when does it become, I'm looking inward and it's all about, you know, this self-discovery that isn't, okay, that isn't, you know, good, consistent with Christianity. Does that make sense? Because I think there's a danger here among some of us who are critical of this therapeutic worldview that will become stoic, right? That we'll dismiss emotions, right? How do we avoid that pitfall?
Well, I hope I said it reasonably well that I'm not at all saying emotions are invalid,
right?
That they're not a real part of our existence, or that it's just weakness, and we should always act like we have no emotions. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, your emotions are instructive to you, you might say.
Yeah.
But if you just go with your emotions all the time, you completely lose sight of the mountain. You should instead be consulting universal values and unchanging values, and examine your own response. I mean, all this is an intellectual thing. It's not just a feeling thing. So, I mean, I think that's a very shorthand way of saying, I think, of trying to respond to the idea that the emotions are valid. But you're right, especially in the Protestant tradition, they're, in fact, I talk about, I forget which book, I think in the book we're talking about now, that if you're going to trace out where did all this come from, and I have a long chapter on that, trying to figure it out, I go back to the Reformation, and in a very short way. I mean, this is not a history book, but to the Reformation is a the beginning of a kind of a continual creedal splintering that makes it that much more difficult to identify what the mountain even is. Mm-hmm. If what we're going to rely on is the movement of the spirit within us, which is valid, that can feel just like one's emotions.
Yeah.
But I think we have to be mentally, intellectually discerning, not just emotionally discerning. You know, one of the people I cite among the positive was A.J. Ayer, when I'm talking about emotivism, famously said, well, the statement murder is wrong is not a statement of morality. Well, what is it then? Yeah. Well, it's a statement of how you feel about murder. Murder is icky.
Oh my gosh.
That's what emotivism is. Because you feel a certain way, it is validated just by that alone.
Yeah.
So that's my response as a way to say that emotions are valid, but they're not the only thing.
Right. Right. And I think that's so important too. I also think too, and I'm increasingly of this mindset that, you know, one of the dangers that we can, especially in the church, we can face is we talk about, and I grew up, you know, evangelical, Pentecostal, Protestant in different ways, was, you know, talk about our personal relationship with God, or it's just me and Jesus kind of idea. And obviously, yeah. I think you can have, you know, there is a relationship you have with God that's distinctive to you in a way. But if you don't put yourself in the context of a Christian community and of a church, the tendency for you to be less discerning in my mind is more there. The temptation for your, you know, if your emotions are signals, for them to be twisted into something that they're not supposed to be read as, right? It's the serpent coming back and saying, did God really say, you know, that?
Yeah.
I think when we're in community and we're among other people, when we're able to reason and talk and pray with others, we're in a position where I'm not saying that heresy and, you know, misinterpretation, failure, it's still possible, but perhaps it's far less likely because we're among people who love us. And we're among people who, you know, have dealt with similar emotions, similar problems, similar challenges, so that when those things come up and we look into ourselves, we're able to read ourselves better because someone else, you know, there are, you know, whether it's people that we're reading, you know, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, Alistair McIntyre, Carl Truman, these types of people, they're helping us read ourselves as are the people who know us best, you know, at our church and in our family, et cetera.
Well, it sounds like you come from a good church environment, and that's and I'm really glad. And everything you said is true if you're in that environment.
Right.
I have a real concern. I have a real concern that our churches, too many of our churches, Well, let me say it the other way, that too many people who would otherwise be in church are sort of disaffected by church, not because, their minds are so open, their brains are falling out,
Right.
but because they are looking for the truth and they feel like the church isn't giving it to them. It's given them platitudes, and its leaders tend to be oblivious to these currents that we've been talking about for the last little while. And not seeing what's actually going on, so that they can tell us about the wolf at the door, so we can guard against it. And that's happening. And there's a lot of people who aren't in church and are not getting the fellowship that you describe, but would like to be. But they're I don't want to say they're unfit. It's not like that. They may recognize the need for community. Christian community, but they can't get past the obtuse, oblivious lack of understanding, not about the creedal beliefs of the church. They may be the leadership of the church may be totally on board with that, but about the creedal beliefs of the society around them, against which there should be a clash, but isn't.
That's a great way, such a great way to put it. I mean, this kind of gets to my whole theme of intellectual discipleship. I don't know if I had sent you that article yet, but I'll share that. But that's exactly. Like, I mean, I'm so glad you said that. I mean, that's such a huge inspiration. That struggle, that challenge, that the absence either of scholars who are not in the churches, or churches who don't know how to minister to scholars, but also the need for churches to grow in their intellectual discipleship because they don't know how to speak to a world that is abandoning them. And this actually goes back. Remember, we were talking about the Pope and society. This goes back to another problem. That on the one hand, we're saying, church may say, "Hey, society, can you read this for me?" But read the scriptures for me. But there's another side to this, which says, well, we're not going to try and understand that world out there at all, right? So I think that that's the other temptation, where on the one hand, there's the temptation to look just like everything outside the church. We don't want to do that, because then why would you come to the church at all if you just look like everyone else, right?
Exactly.
But it's pointless. But at the same time, there's also the sense of, yeah, but do you even understand what's going on out there, and how well do you understand it? I had a pastor just last week calling me. He calls me, he says, "Josh, can you just explain critical theory to me?" I said, "Dude, I have 15 minutes. Like, what are you?" But I mean, that was a, I think that was, it was a sincere attempt. Like, he's like, I know this is in my church, and I know that people are responding in this way, but I don't, I've never read it. I don't know how to understand it.
Well, good for him. But too many people aren't doing that.
Right.
And the ones that are doing it should have done it 10 years ago.
Yes.
And I'll tell you this too. I know for a fact that there are major respected churches that teach critical theory, and as long as you don't use the phrase critical theory, you're A-okay. I mean, they don't understand that they're teaching critical theory because they don't understand what it is. They just don't like the term because they know their parishioners don't like the term.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And we could go on and on about this, but I think there's so much about this that really gets me excited in a way to wrestle with the problem, but also, frustrated with the problem itself. And I hope that if you're listening to this and you're enjoying this conversation, you will think about joining us for future events or something, because the conversation Bert and I are having right now is extremely Ciceronian in its flavor. So I'm grateful. Thank you so much for joining us, Bert. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a joy. I appreciate it.
Excellent. All right, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. And if you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th, 2026. Paper and panel proposals are due September 1, and we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.